meet in tonight from New York City. Is peace possible in the Middle East? Here, Lord Wilmot, Hussein Kamel Salim Bey, and Morris Eller. Hear all sides and make up your own mind.
Thank you very much. Now, first, let's hear a few sample questions from our audience. Questions, please.
Lord Wilmot, since the Labour Party has nationalized most of Britain's industry, how can Britain possibly object to Iran's nationalization of oil?
Thank you. Next question.
Professor Salim, now that Britain is out of Egypt, are you not completely free to develop your own resources?
Thank you. A question from the gentleman.
Mr. Ernst, since the United Nations was responsible for the establishment of the State of Israel, should it not also accept responsibility for the resettlement of 750,000 Arab refugees?
Thank you very much. Now, in just a moment, you'll hear Lord Wilmot, Salim Bey, and Morris L. Ernst answer these and other questions from our representative town meeting audience. So keep listening.
Tonight, we're happy to welcome to this country the Egyptian Town Hall Mission, which arrived in New York last Saturday for a 6 weeks tour of the United States. When town meeting first made its first world tour in the summer of 1949 to 12 world capitals with 28 representatives of 28 American organizations, we encouraged our hosts in each city to organize similar groups to visit our country to exchange views with Americans in America through people-to-people discussions. Egypt is the first to organize such a mission, which is headed by one of our speakers on tonight's program, Professor Salim. The party includes an outstanding educator and historian, a newspaper editor, a labor leader, a film producer, a leader of women's affairs, a graduate student of anthropology, and a member of the Egyptian delegation to the United Nations. They are beginning their coast-to-coast tour of 6 weeks in New York, and you will probably hear from some of them during the question period in tonight's discussion. Now to preside over tonight's discussion, here is your moderator, Mr. George V. Denny, Jr. Mr. Denny.
Good evening, neighbors. The explosive situation in Iran had not yet developed when we planned tonight's program. This town meeting was planned to coincide with the arrival of the Egyptian Town Hall Mission, a party of eight distinguished and representative Egyptians who are returning our visit to Cairo on our world tour in the summer of 1949. We're indeed happy to welcome as our guests tonight and to see this tangible result of our people-to-people mission inaugurated 2 years ago. This mission will visit 12 American cities during the next 6 weeks, and their mission, like ours, will be to learn and to exchange views through people-to-people discussions arranged by local host committees in these cities. Tonight, as we explore the crucial situation in the Middle East, we ask all of you to think of yourselves as citizens of the world and members of the human race, a viewpoint we must learn to develop if we are to survive the present crisis in world affairs. But we must not be so unrealistic as to completely disregard nationalisms, race, or creed as we work toward higher ground. Hence, we've invited representatives of three viewpoints. Our old friend Lord Wilmot, former British Minister of Supply, to present a British view. The leader of the Egyptian Town Hall Mission and Dean of the Commerce Faculty of Fouad First University at Cairo, Hussein Kamel Salim Bey, to give an Egyptian view. And Morris L. Ernst, distinguished New York lawyer, who's recently returned from an extensive trip to Egypt, to present an American view. We'll hear first from the Right Honorable Lord Wilmot. Lord Wilmot.
Mr. Denny, the events in the Eastern world, the Near East as well as the Far East, must be seen, I think, to be understood against the background of what I'll call the Great Awakening. This awakening of self-conscious nationhood may be one of those great, vast changes which through the centuries have profoundly affected all mankind. Now I suggest that Britain has shown that she appreciates the magnitude and possibilities of this great awakening in the East, and that she is ready to recognize it and to assist it in its new desire for development and for freedom. Evidence is the granting of independence in India, in Pakistan, and in Ceylon, which have now become entirely self-governing countries. That is in tune with recognition of this great Eastern movement. British policy in these countries applies also in the near and the far east. These changes, we think, should be accomplished peacefully and without economic and social and political clash, upset, and chaos. We say, come and sit down at a table. Let's talk it over and work our solution that fits the new times. If these changes are not brought about by peaceful negotiation and agreement, and if necessary, arbitration, then there will be chaos, so deep and so wide that the whole area may be thrown wide open to conflict. We found a successful solution in India and in Ceylon and in Pakistan. And our attitude was the same in Israel. We tried hard to work out a solution that would meet the legitimate demands of both Jews and Arabs. When this attempt broke down, bloodshed resulted. We did all we could to stop the fight. When peace was restored, Britain has done her utmost to help the Jews and the Arabs to go forward in a new way. Britain has always been a friend of the Arab countries. She's now recognized as a good friend and a helper of the new state of Israel. And Britain wants to do the same in Iran. Here, British capital and enterprise have built up a most valuable oil economy in that country. We recognize in modern times, there have got to be changes in the form in which a foreign enterprise can operate in another overseas country. Even when, as in this case, that foreign enterprise has brought immense benefits to the country where it operates. And now, Mr. Denny, I'll answer the question that was put to me from the hall. We do not deny the right of the Iran government to nationalize the oil. Certainly not. But nationalization in Britain has honored every contract and paid for every bit of property at market value. And we say that this should be done wherever changes are brought about. And we say it is wrong to tear up contracts and to repudiate agreements which have involved valuable benefits for both sides. Here we say sit down at the table and work out a new solution. We do protest at the unilateral scrapping of contracts without compensation. Well, sir, I say that Britain has played a big part in these areas. Our record in Egypt is a good one. We're proud of it. We brought great benefits to the people of that country. The great irrigation schemes on the Nile are part of the work that we've done. We've left a legacy in the Near East of law and order and public health and education. And we think that the changes which have to be made should be made in good order, that the progress which has been made should not be thrown away. We think that is a better way than scrapping and repudiation. It's no good talking about freedom and self-determination. We've got to make those things a reality for the benefit of the people who live in those areas.
Thank you, Lord Wilmot. Unless I'm mistaken, we're going to hear a different interpretation of British foreign policy from our next speaker, Hussein Kamel Salim Bey, Dean of the Faculty of Commerce at Powell First University at Cairo, who received much of his education in England. Though a scholar, he's an enthusiastic sportsman, president of the Egyptian Hockey Federation, and now has introduced baseball to Egypt. Professor Salim.
In answering tonight's question, I feel, Lord Wilmot, that I should follow the advice of your countryman, the late Lord Lytton. Let enemies be cautious, friends should be frank. So I shall use the privilege of friends and be frank with you about how we feel in our part of the world. There are two dangers threatening peace in the Middle East. One is long-term and deadly. I mean communist expansionism, which we, like all freedom-loving people, acutely feel and are determined to withstand. The other is present, perhaps less grave, but nonetheless extremely disturbing. I mean our relations with Israel and our old but unsolved problems with Britain. We strongly feel that our difficulties with Israel and with Britain are preventing us from taking proper measures of defense against the real enemy, are tying our hands behind our back, so to speak, and are hindering us from standing as firmly beside our democratic friends as we would like to do. I think you will agree with me, Lord Wilmot and Mr. Ernst, that the circumstances which brought Israel into being 3 years ago, against the expressed wishes of the whole Arab world, were calculated to poison relations between the two sides for a considerable time. The sad plight of hundreds of thousands of refugees, human beings like yourselves, cruelly driven from their homes to eat their hearts out in the desert, is an ever-present tragedy to fill us with sorrow and with shame. Besides, the frequent border incidents between Israel and her Arab neighbors are a constant reminder of the explosive nature of the situation there. It's extremely unrealistic now to talk of peace between the two sides. It is simply out of the question. As regards relations with Britain, I'm afraid, Lord Wilmot, that your satisfaction with the British record in the Middle East is not shared by the people of that area. Your forces have occupied Egypt for some 70 years. You have deliberately kept our army short of equipment, and yet you blame us for our present weakness and refuse to budge from your base on the Suez Canal. Here, I must answer the question put before me. Egypt is without her...
We've got too many papers there, boy.
Too many papers.
Sorry. Here it is.
I'm sorry. The question put for me tonight, British forces had not yet left Egypt. If they had, there would be no problem with Britain. It's all very well to say, let us get round the table and settle our differences. Egypt has been sitting round that table for 30 years, trying in vain to rid herself of British occupation and to unite herself with her southern province, the Sudan. How much longer must she remain reasonable and go on negotiating? Must the revulsion of feeling against the West, which has lately appeared in Iran, be repeated in other countries of the Middle East? Must the United States continue to pander to British interests till the democracies lose the whole of the Arab world? It seems the height of pity that Britain, who's always claiming to be the friend of the Arabs, should not act as such and set them free. Not until there is a settlement with Israel, and until Britain finally relinquishes her conception of the Middle East as her special sphere of influence, will there be real peace in the Middle East. Then, and only then, will you be assured of the loyal and unshakable friendship of the 100 million Arabs who live in this vital area of the world.
Thank you, Salim Bey. It's quite impossible, of course, to select any one person and say that he represents the American viewpoint, especially during these times when we can't be quite sure what the American viewpoint is. But I'm sure that no one will object when we say that our next speaker, Mr. Morris L. Ernst, the distinguished New York attorney, author, and publicist, will give an American viewpoint on this subject. Mr. Ernst has been in the vanguard of the fight for civil liberties in this country, is the author of a book on this subject called The First Freedom, and his special qualifications for tonight's discussion is his study of and recent extensive trip to the Middle East, including Egypt. Mr. Morris Ernst.
Please. My answer to the question of the evening is an emphatic yes. But I warn you, I am a glandular optimist. I must say my position lies in between that of Lord Wilmot and Professor Salim. The American people have a deep concern in the Middle East. At this moment, I agree there are two obvious tender spots. One, the possible penetration of communist Russia into Iran, plus the unilateral scrapping of contracts without adequate compensation. As Americans, we cannot philosophically oppose the sovereign rights of nationalization. But nationalization without fair repayment will reduce the flow of American capital into other lands in the Middle East. Thus, Professor Salim, is not Iran imperiling the flow of capital to the neighboring states? All of the nations of the Middle East should band together to persuade Iran that any nationalization of oil must be with fair compensation. Moreover, to the American consumers, the loss of Iranian oil to a communist-controlled Iran will not only affect gasoline consumption in the United States, but will deeply affect our defense program. Two, to answer the question directed to me, the United Nations, of course, should resettle the Arab refugees. The 750,000 Arab refugees from Palestine living out their lives in concentration camps are an obvious source of irritation.